Do. I'm happy to introduce our next speakers in our panel, Missionary Science, and we're going to start off with a collaboration between Skip Altimer and Marcia Orgeron. Skip.
Science! Somebody had to say it. All right. I'm Skip Altimer, and I'm with the AV Geeks Educational Archive. And today, Marcia Orgeron and I are going to be talking about the Moody Institute of Science. If we can bring up the PowerPoint, or actually bring up the laptop. I'm not very PowerPoint savvy, so I made a DVD that has menus for slides, so I apologize for that. But anyways, if you have ever read the books by Heather Hendershot and James Gilbert, you may be familiar with the Moody Institute of Science, or MIS for short. These texts were very helpful in our research for this presentation and a paper that we've actually written together. And while the books were excellent resources, we found that they really didn't touch upon the school films that MIS made. And we hope to shed some light on those films today and give you kind of a brief anecdotal, informal history, but also kind of a nifty clip reel of MIS films. So the first MIS film that I ever ran across was the Carnivorous Plants. And this was from a collection of films that I got from a North Carolina film library. When I watched the film, I noticed it was very similar to another film I had called Living Traps, where it talked about plants which trapped and digested insects, like the Venus flytrap and the pitcher plant. However, the similarity between those two films ends with the conclusion of the MIS film, which we'll see right here.
Talk about your traps. This is a working model of one of the most fantastic traps ever built. Now the prey approaches, triggers the mechanism. This trap even resets itself. Now, can you imagine building all of this complicated mechanism into a trap the size of the head of this pin? God, beauty. The plant itself, the utricularia, lives beneath the surface of the water. Each of the small globular objects is a trap, much more complicated than our working model. The trap itself is so tiny that it will take a microscope to see it work. But if we're fortunate, we can actually see the plant trap tiny animals. Notice the guide hairs and the three small trigger hairs. Now, don't blink your eyes. You're liable to miss the catch. This little animal doesn't know which way to go, and he's just the kind of a fellow Utricularia likes to have around. Did you see it? Well, I told you not to blink. You see, the catch is actually made in a 50th of a second. Now watch closely this time. When we see such a complex mechanism as this, and remember, it's no larger than the head of a pin, man's best traps look strangely cold and ineffective by comparison. Man's progress has not been due to discovery of new things, but merely to the uncovering of principles and devices that God ordained in nature.
So I could tell by your laughter that you noticed the mention of God in a science film from a public school. Seems a little odd. And I was thinking the same thing when I saw it. I was like, well, wait a minute. This film came from a public school, and how did it get in that library? Was this somebody's sneaky attempt to kind of subvert the teachings of evolution, or wasn't this film a violation of the separation of church and state? So I started looking for these films on eBay, and as I acquired other collections, I realized that these films were all over the place, all over the U.S., and public school systems all over. And I was wondering, well, could this have happened by accident? You know, is this was this part of some great plan? And I wanted to know more about this organization and their agenda. So the host of most of the MIS films is Dr. Irwin A. Moon, who is quite the showman. And it's interesting that how many times the word science and showmen have shown up in the presentations today, and he was actually a very good showman. In fact, he was a minister who had always been interested in science. And he always felt that demonstrating the wonders of science was actually demonstrating the wonders of God. So he would often incorporate experiments into some of his sermons. Now, these became very popular, and he started touring around under the name Sermons of Science, doing lectures all over the country. One such experiment that he would do was the million-volt man experiment. In this demonstration, he would actually hook himself up to this electrical apparatus, and he would have bolts of electricity coming from his fingers. He would also hold onto a piece of wood, which in his hands would catch fire. His explanation in doing this is he would say that the human body was in tune with the 60-cycle electric current, and that if the frequencies of the current were stepped up to 65,000 cycles, it would pass through his body without harm. In other words, his life depends on obeying certain natural laws. He pointed out how foolish it would be for him to disregard such laws, concluding that there are also spiritual laws which every human must obey and believe or suffer the consequences. So these demonstrations were very popular, very, very popular. He toured many churches, many evangelical events, attracted the attention of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. So they teamed up, and they did tours all over the country. In 1945, I think that dates right. Yeah, 1945, they teamed up and created the Moody Institute of Science, which was based in California. And what they realized is doing these live demonstrations was very effective, but it was also very draining. They realized that if they made films of these demonstrations and then distributed those, that would be a more efficient way to get their message across. And so the Moody Institute of Science was the audiovisual branch of the Moody Bible Institute. One of the first films they made was God of Creation, but they also made ones God of Adam, Signpost Aloft, many, many titles. All of them were around like 40 minutes or so. Now, time-lapse flowers, we talked about those earlier. What made the MIS films very popular was the same aspect of showmanship. They took great pains to use time-lapse photography and microphotography to visually captivate their audiences. Many times they were given critical acclaim because they really went the extra effort. Instead of, you know, buying some stock footage, they would actually film it themselves. David Shepard was talking to us last night, and he mentioned that MIS was a complete in-house production. They shot the film, they edited the film, they developed the film, and they duplicated the film and sold it and distributed it. David said the reason why is that that MIS did not want non-Christians touching their films. In the mid-1950s, MIS created an educational division that produced films for schools. They would often edit down the longer films, the ones that were 40 minutes or so, down to 11-minute or 20-minute things that would address a single topic. One such film was The Electric Eagle. And the reason why I think that this film is really great is it still shows off Moon's showmanship and makes a point.
Even some of the folks here at the laboratory been just a little bit skeptical about Joe's electrical prowess. And for that reason, we've asked a few of them if they wouldn't help us in an experiment. Will you have the group come in now, please? All right. Dave, you stand right over here, please. The rest of you just line up there. You're right over here, Humphrey. That's fine. Now, Dave, you take this, please, and hold it in your right hand. Roy, you hold this. That's fine. Now, everybody join hands. That's right. Now you're connected in series. Now there are five of you. That means that each of you will receive just 1/5 of the total voltage of the eel. We'll give you the low voltage path first. Ready? Did you feel that? That was bad, wasn't it? I'd like to have you be a group of confirmed believers of electric eel. Thank you very much.
Quite the showman. Very, very a lot of fun to watch. And I really, when I collected more and more of these films, I really liked Moon's approach. He's a very likable guy. Now, in 1958, the Eisenhower administration introduced the National Defense Education Act. The NDEA was created to stimulate teaching of science, mathematics, and modern foreign languages in public schools. The idea was that this was a response to our concern that we were lagging behind the Soviets in technology and science, given that they had just launched Sputnik the previous year. So a lot of money flowed into schools, and they were able to actually purchase audiovisual equipment and films that were appropriate for that. Now, MIS films actually qualified for this because they were actually science films. They were advertised as science films. Now, what's interesting about this is that in the advertising that we've seen in trade journals such as Educational Screen, there's no mention of the religious agenda in them at all. It's just to say, well, here's, for example, this slide. I don't know if you can see it very well. It's talking about a film that we'll show later. It's called Fish Out of Water, which talks about the Grunion and its life cycle. But there's no mention of the religious agenda that's associated with that. In their books, Hendershot and Gilbert mentioned that MIS actually removed the religious content from their films, from the larger films, for these smaller educational films. But what we found is that wasn't the case at all, that they actually toned down the evangelical content of it. The religious message is still very much there. And I have two clips that we're going to be showing. one is from Mystery of Time, which is about Einstein's relativity and about how if you look at a distant star, you're actually looking in the past, but then it somehow switches gears and talks about moral responsibility. The next clip is, it's kind of strange. The next clip is Blind as a Bat, which talks about bats and their unique echolocation skills and where those skills came from. In theory, these will come on next.
Well, you were on the chart, too. You could see what you were doing 9 years ago, because you're still doing it. Gives you something to think about, doesn't it? You know, it's an important thing for us to recognize the possibility that every act, good or bad, lives on and on, that we are forever accountable for our actions. But responsibility is the stuff of which character is. And accepting a full measure of responsibility is the highest challenge before any young person today. Mickey was an orphan when we found him, but he quickly became the lab pet. Somehow he had his own ideas about food, and even a doll's nursing bottle wasn't much of an attraction at first. But it wasn't long before Mickey felt right at home with his bottle. And in a few short days, the two were inseparable. They are guided in flight by the echoes of their own signal cries. And that's actually a kind of radar. Man's radar is extremely complex, and a high degree of learning is necessary to maintain operation. But the bat, small, unattractive animal, carried a most remarkable radar well concealed in its tiny head. We know now that the bat was using radar long before it was even a dream in the mind of man. Obviously a part of an intelligent plan, but whose intelligence was involved? The bat's?
Okay, so besides the obligatory orphan reference, the text of Bat, Blind as a Bat might sound really familiar if you've been following the debate about public schools teaching intelligent design as an alternative to evolution. It's funny, Marcia and I kind of proposed and started working on this presentation and article long before the court battle started appearing about teaching intelligent design. And the message of intelligent design is that there is an intelligent person who has planned all of this. And so it's just fascinating to see this. And it's so strikingly similar that I just kind of wonder if these films, which were paid for with federal money, were distributed all throughout the country in the mid-50s, and the people that saw these films said, yeah, they've got a point, and then later created intelligent design. I don't have proof for that, but it's just so odd that or so similar that the dialogue and the what they use. Now, Moody Institute of Science in the 50s did really well, 60s did well, 70s not so great, and the religious message, eventually schools started purging these films and not using them, although we did find a professor who actually is using a film, Mystery of Time, still today, because some of the visuals are just so stunning, and they talk about things that no other film talk about, not the religious aspects of it, but just the content is interesting. Now, according to Heather Hendershot, these films truly are orphaned because the Moody Bible Institute, which eventually got rid of the Moody Institute of Science, they don't have the original films or the elements in their archives. They distribute these 30-minute kind of cut-down versions of their fuller films on VHS and DVD, but many of these are actually from faded prints, as you saw. And I'd love to know more about the fate of MIS films. If anybody ever knows about it, you know, we can maybe talk about it or come and find me, because I'd love to know kind of what happened to all these films. So now it's time for Marcia.
Okay, my portion of the presentation is called What's the Purpose of All This? The Creator's Plan in an Age of Human Intervention. MIS worked to shift their image away from associations with gospel science in the secular trade press in the 1950s, but their educational films repeatedly demonstrate that science and technology can only take us so far. A divine plan offers the only viable, in fact, the only acknowledged explanation for natural phenomena. Looking at the Institute's 1950s films, we find little in the way of attempts to conceal the religious and moral framework into which these biological studies literally contain the knowledge they present. Fish Out of Water was released in 1954, the year that MIS launched its school program, turning its attentions to producing films that had the potential to reach a wide audience of the unconverted. According to a January 1955 MIS advertisement from Educational Screen, the film is intended for elementary, junior high, senior high, and college students. The advertisement briefly describes the film without any reference to religious content, as you can see. The description of Fish Out of Water, as with the 9 other films promoted in this 2-page advertisement, makes no mention of anything beyond the literal subject matter and the technology used to capture it. Whereas the late 1940s and early 1950s MIS advertisements, which often refer consumers to the Moody Bible Institute and not to the Moody Institute of Science, frequently touted the degree to which their films show how the wonders of science prove the existence of the God of the Scriptures, that's a quote, as in this June 1950 advertisement, there appears to be an effort to move away from promoting the religious aspect of MIS films at the middle of the decade. By the time of their December 1956 full-page campaign in Educational Screen, which brags of the MIS IA factor, which is translated as interest arousal, there is no indication that these films contain any suggestion of religious content, merely that they provide a never-to-be-forgotten lesson in science. But despite what may have been a strategic promotional move away from religion, the content of MIS films did not sway from the course. And we'll be screening now a complete Moody film, a 16-millimeter print of Fish Out of Water from 1954. It's 11 minutes, and it's courtesy of the AV Geeks Archive.
If we were to visit the beaches of Southern California on certain spring and summer evenings, we'd find them dotted with campfires. But the people around these fires are not picnickers. Believe it or not, these folks are fishing. Yes, brunion fishing. And by tradition, the hot dogs and the marshmallows are all a part of this unusual sport. But now it's H-hour on brunion night, and here comes the lookout shouting, "Hey, brunion, come on!" And they're off to the strangest sport on earth. But wait a minute. Where's the fishing tackle?
You can't fish without poles or nets, or can you? It looks like all you need for this kind of fishing is a reckless enthusiasm and a good boarding house grab. Oh, yes, and a bucket. You really have some fun trying to carry an armload of these fellows. Yes, and dry clothes to go home in are a must for Grundian fishermen. Because in the excitement, something like this always seems to happen. Fish out of water. And it's no accident either. These fish deliberately come out of the water to lay their eggs on shore. The only fish in the world that spawn on land. Here is a spectacle so unique, it can be witnessed nowhere in the world except on a few Southern California beaches. Fish nesting on land. One of the rarest of all biological phenomena. Fish depend upon water for life, just as we depend upon air. And yet, at the very risk of life itself, both the male and the female grunion come out of the water into this foreign, hostile environment. The male fertilizes the eggs as the female lays them, and then the female begins a desperate struggle for survival. If she misses the next wave, she has little chance to survive. What's the purpose of all this? Does it just happen? Could it be a part of a plan? Well, let's see. The eggs are always laid when the water is far up on the beach. Then, night after night, the waters recede until they reach the lowest tide. By then, the eggs may be hundreds of feet from the water's edge, far from the element in which the fish must eventually live. Here the eggs develop, lying buried in the warm, moist sand. It's possible to find these eggs by digging almost anywhere along the high tide line. Careful searching uncovers tiny pockets of these brightly colored eggs. In the laboratory, and with the aid of a microscope, one can actually watch the embryonic development. Normally, this development takes place while the eggs are buried under the sand. But these eggs were fertilized here in the laboratory only seconds ago. And now one is being prepared for observation. Within this tiny egg, a miracle is about to take place. With the aid of the lapse-time photomicrographic equipment, which compresses days into seconds on the screen, we'll be able to witness this amazing spectacle, the magical unfolding of life through cell division. The first faint stirrings of life come when the blastodermal cap, seen in the circle, divides into two separate cells. In about 30 minutes, the second cleavage becomes evident, resulting in four cells. Successive divisions produce 8, 16, 32, 64, and so on up into the hundreds of thousands of cells. The circular objects in the center of the egg are globules of oil which will supply food for the growing embryonic fish. The transparent cluster of cells at the top of the egg is the fish in the making. It contains all the characteristics of the adult grunion. Its size, its shape, its habits. Yes, and even the germ of that mysterious wisdom by which it will someday be able to perfectly time its spawning with the movement of the tides. With every surge, the cells divide, until eventually there will be millions upon millions of them, each having just as much claim to being the original cell as any of the millions of others. And yet they're all different. Soon they'll take their places in the various parts of the body as bones and blood and scales and fins. Out of this indistinguishable mass of cells, in some mysterious unknown way, the form of a fish is building up around an invisible, intangible framework. But where is the mold or the pattern that is shaping these cells into a living creature? The first recognizable features are the head and the eye. the opposite side of the egg, the tail is beginning to form. At this stage of its growth, the embryonic fish is 4 days old. The head and the eyes are well formed now, and the simple heart, already at work, can be seen. After 8 to 10 days, the egg is ready to hatch. But remember, when it does, it will be a fish. So now we see there has to be a plan. If the egg were to hatch while buried here in the sand, far from the water, it wouldn't have a chance in the world to live. But the grunion egg never hatches until the water reaches it, and then it hatches instantly. You can keep these eggs buried in the sand for weeks or even months and they won't hatch. But now let's pour some salt water on them and see what happens. Hatching of the egg is just as definitely connected with the movement of the tides as is the spawning. There are two main tides which have their peak at the full and the dark of the moon. This complex pattern represents the rise and fall of the daily tides over a period of a month. Suppose the eggs were laid any night before the peak tide. A higher tide the following night would wash them out of the sheltering sand and expose them to their enemies. Or, if they were laid on a night too long after the peak, they would be washed out by a rising tide just a few nights later before they had a chance to develop. Actually, there are only a few nights when the grunion can lay her eggs successfully, when the tide is at its peak or the first few nights after the peak. And she must choose not only the right night, but the right hour of that night. For even if she should lay her eggs on the right night, but when the tide is still rising, they would be washed out by that very tide. Or if she should wait too long after the peak and lay her eggs while that night's tide is receding, they would be washed out by the rising tide of the next night and destroyed. Only during this magic hour can the eggs be laid where they will develop safely. But that isn't all. For during this hour, certain waves are higher than others. So the grunion has to choose not only the right month, the right night of that month, and the right hour of that night, but even the right wave during that hour. Terrible and treacherous are the times. The story of their treachery has been recorded along many a fog-bound rocky coast. How is it that a tiny fish, the grunion, is able to turn these tides so destructive to man to its own advantage, and by them preserve its very life and the life of its young? This tremendous capability must be a part of the Creator's plan for the preservation of the grunion.
Okay, unlike many of the MIS films, Fish Out of Water does not feature Erwin Moon on screen or off, instead employing frequent Moody Bible Institute actor David Wisner as a narrator. In the beginning of Fish Out of Water, Wisner, of course, alerts us to the Southern California phenomena of grunion hunting, or fishing. Images of evening beachgoers roasting marshmallows over bonfires suggest the festive mood in which the strangest sport on earth transpires. The jovial opening images, however, run counter to the film's remaining narration, which marvels over the risk taken by Grunion when they come out of water into a, quote, foreign hostile environment to mate and lay their eggs. This desperate struggle for survival is, according to an early comment in the film, no accident either, the recurrent phrasing used to invoke the higher power allegedly orchestrating these wonders. The narrator's rhetorical strategy here does not immediately reveal the design of the designer, except through implication. The film later suggests that a mysterious wisdom guides the humble Grunion, a fish out of water, which seems to bear a near allegorical relation to the MIS films themselves. Unlike the nocturnally marauding Grunion hunters, a Moody Institute scientist is shot hunting the beach in the light of day for eggs, which he digs up and whisks away to the ultimate MIS mise-en-scene, the laboratory, signaled by a close-up of a sand and Grunion egg-filled beaker. Our narrator informs us that, quote, in the laboratory and with the aid of a microscope, one can actually watch the embryonic development. Normally, this development takes place while the eggs are buried under the sand, but these eggs were fertilized here in the laboratory only seconds ago. Following this frank acknowledgement of the scientist's capacity for doing what amounts to God's work, which is the kind of work that Moon later in The Mystery of Time from 1957 compares to the doctor's disastrous pursuits in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the film provides a series of images of the various technological marvels of the lab, from simple microscopes to complex dials and flashing lights that enable the camera to capture the embryonic development of the tiny Grunion. What becomes most striking in this unfolding scientific experiment is the dissonant vocabulary with which our narrator explains what is transpiring. And you will remember this. Within this tiny egg, a miracle is about to take place. With the aid of the lapse time photomicrographic equipment, which compresses days into seconds on the screen, we'll be able to witness this amazing spectacle, the magical unfolding of life through cell division. Miracles, magic, and photomicrography coexist in Moon's universe, the former revealed by the latter. However, this process of bearing witness is complicated by the degree to which science is sacrificed in the name of magic, the ultimate unscientific faith which is required of an audience if they are to follow the narrator to his conclusion. Indeed, despite the fact that the film shows us the Grunion cells dividing, eyes and heart forming, and the like, the narration still insists that the fish is generated in some mysterious, unknown way. Like so many MIS 1950s educational films, Fish Out of Water seems only to see what it wants to see, asking its audience, where is the mold or the pattern that is shaping these cells into a living creature? This is, however, a rhetorical question. The narrator attempts to overwhelm the viewer with the mysterious nature of this entire affair, informing us with certainty that there has to be a plan, as images of confusing tidal and lunar charts are accompanied by discussions of the seemingly impossible circumstances which the Grunion requires to successfully mate, lay eggs, return to the sea, and produce offspring. The suggested plan is MIS's attempt to rupture the scientific explanation of the fish's adaptation to its environment. In fact, many MIS nature films rely upon this trope of questioning evolution by casting doubt onto how an unintelligent animal possesses a fantastic physical trait, such as the sonar used by the bat in Blind as a Bat, or the electric pulses generated by an electric eel in The Electric Eel. It is then precisely the complexity of the natural world that acts as a kind of brick wall in MIS's cinematic logic. Fish Out of Water is at pains to present the complexity of Grunion reproduction, both in the field and in the laboratory, but the film's intent is to suggest that such complexity, you know, quote, must be a part of the creator's plan for the preservation of the Grunion, which is, of course, how the film ends. This concluding message, however, is greatly at odds with the images with which the film begins, right, of the happy Grunion hunters, whose recreation involves interrupting the divine plan that the remainder of the film dramatizes. It is perhaps surprising, then, that the film appears little more than amused by this interruption of God's work. Both hunter and scientist so easily thwart the creator's plan in a fashion that raises questions regarding human responsibility that this particular MIS film does not ask, but which later films such as The Mystery of Time, which includes serious meditations on the atomic age and on man's role in it, seems at pains to confront. Because of the peculiar nature of the Grunion's breeding patterns, Fish Out of Water also fails to engage with a crucial MIS thesis, which recurs in a number of their educational films, that devoted parenting and the education of children is both evident in the primitive natural world and in superior fashion in the developed modern world. 3 years after Fish Out of Water, MIS released A Fish Family, this is 1957, which stands as a kind of aquatic cousin that more than compensates for this earlier omission. Instead of encountering fish in nature, this foreign hostile environment of the Southern California beach, A Fish Family takes as its subject fish, blue acaras, in an artificial and totally controlled environment, a fish tank, both in the home where it serves as an educational tool for children and in the laboratory where it may undergo technologically mediated observation. According to the MIS Educational Film Utilization Guide that accompanied this film about fish famous for the care of their young, that's a quote, it is aimed at primary school audiences and was marketed as a science film and not a social studies film. As the utilization guide tells us, this is a quote, the devotion, teamwork, and mutual relationships that go to make up a family of fish are so vividly portrayed that they seem to suggest an ideal human family, unquote. Young viewers are, in other words, encouraged to see in the behavioral patterns of the acara reflections of their own family life, at least to a certain degree. Erwin Moon, our off-screen narrator, begins the film by asking a question. Did you know it is possible to be a scientist even when you are very young? One of the most important things is to learn how to observe. That is, to learn how to watch things closely and carefully to see how they are made and how they work. Our narrator goes on to note how wonderfully made fish are to exist in their watery world before leading us to what the film terms, quote, the most fascinating thing about these little creatures, their family life. So far, the images we've seen have been strictly of life inside the tank, but at this moment, the camera reframes to show us that this tank is in the living room of an American family, whose two curious children peer at the contents as Moon asks, have you ever watched a father and mother fish raise a family? The question signals a change in setting from the family room to the MIS laboratory, where a photographer and his camera go to heroic lengths to document this fish family's history. Revolving around truly fascinating images of the mother and father acara's preparation for mating and child-rearing, these pictures tell a particularly timely American story of the perfect team devoted to taking care of their young. With the repeatedly emphasized importance of the faithful parents guarding first the eggs and then the tiny acara hatchlings, A Fish Family speaks clearly to the need for a fortified family structure in the face of Cold War-era threats. The overarching irony of this, of course, is that the film depicts fish life in an aquarium. Safe from anything but scientific meddling and the occasional demonstration of a non-acara fish's curiosity. This, of course, in comparison with the ill-fated grunion we encounter in the real-world opening sequence of Fish Out of Water. For the acara family, science is in fact the only real threat. An object that looks like a thermometer is thrust into the tank to show the parents in guardian mode attempting to defend their nursery from this alien intrusion. If we are to take this film, indeed this pair of films, as parables of sorts for relevant lessons bearing on contemporary life as filtered through the MIS lens, they reveal an ideological pattern reflected by several of MIS's own questions in their A Fish Family's utilization guide. What would happen if the eggs were left unguarded? Do you think the parents were devoted to their babies? Why? How did the baby fish show their obedience to their parents? If Fish Out of Water illustrates, perhaps in spite of itself, the dangers wrought by unthinking human intervention in the creator's plan, then A Fish Family offers a highly moralizing corrective in which children are obligated to obey their parents, not only for their safety, but for the survival of their species. Moon's narration also elevates the human obligation above the animal, noting that the love of parents for their children is different and far more wonderful than that of the acara. The final moments of the film, however, greet us with a rather abrupt shift in tone from the admiring and wondrous observation of what has preceded it, as Moon tells us that the acara aren't simply an example of what children might do, but rather that God requires that children obey their parents. This moment recalls an earlier and somewhat awkward moment in the film during which we see one of the acara eating some of the eggs that they had been so diligent in protecting. Moon guides our viewing of this cannibalistic scene, telling us that the white eggs are eaten because they'll never become fish anyways. Without any explanation beyond this, the moment is shocking precisely because of the anthropomorphism that the film so ardently pursues elsewhere. What message might the primary school mind take from this moment? One that is perhaps not surprisingly absent from the discussion questions that follow in the utilization guide. Last paragraph. What that guide does not neglect, however, is a one-sentence explanation of the film's moral and spiritual values. This is the quote. The courage, faithfulness, and devotion of the parent fish and the obedience of the young ones demonstrate very graphically the importance of these God-given things when put into action in making a happy family. These films may have been marketed in the context of science education, but a reframing of this conception is in order. It is more to the point that science, and the sense that American schools desperately needed engaging, technologically innovative ways to teach it, provided MIS a structure and a guise in and by which they could compel young people to, oddly enough, abandon the logical conclusions of science. The laboratory, the family room, and the Southern California beach all provide a setting in which MIS films dramatize the wonder of nature, only to lead their viewers to a point of incomprehension, literally using science and technology to awe their spectators into believing in a divine creator. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcia and Skip. Next up, Devin Orgeron.
Thank you. My talk today is titled Spreading the Word, the Science of Contagion in Edgar Ulmer's TB Films.